Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to So Bad It's Good with Ryan Bailey, presented by Betches Media. This is an exploration of all pop culture, from the classic reality TV moments of the past and present to the latest Daily Mail headlines and everything in between. We'll dive into all the infamous and notorious messes you can't stop watching. We're looking at you, Tom Sandoval. Folks, welcome to your Tuesday episode of So Bad It's Good with Ryan Bailey. This is your pal Ryan. We have fully entered the week. I hope it has been a smooth launch for you guys. I hope you enjoyed the pop culture roundup on Monday. We had one of my faves, Nicole Travolta, and I also did an hour-long pop culture roundup of a lot of Bravo stories, a lot of pop culture. So I hope you enjoyed that if you checked it out. And listen, today we're here. We're at a new season of Vanderpump Rules premiering tonight. And I will be doing a full recap, a line-by-line recap, where I will lose my mind like I did last season. It'll probably start small, and you'll just gradually I will lose my mind as the season progresses. But that'll be out on Wednesday, since I have a screener copy of that. And then we'll switch probably to Thursdays so I can have a day in between to really collect my thoughts about the madness that is going to ensue. How are you guys? Are you good? I hope you're good. I really do. We have a great show for you today. We have Emily D. Baker. Emily D. Baker is just one of the best legal analysts out there, but she is she's a Bravo head, and her commentary is just so damn good. I mean, I'm so happy that she mainly focuses on, the legal system and court cases, because she would put us all out of business if she was doing just a straight up Bravo podcast or Bravo YouTube. In fact, we did this interview last week, and I wish she had done it today, because the Murdaugh trial, they had a whole nother hearing if he was going to be granted a new trial. And there was some weird janky stuff going on, I guess, with the jury, where that was a possibility, but he was not granted a new trial. This Murdaugh guy just seems like a bad dude. If you watch any of those documentaries, I mean, there seem to be like four different Murdaugh documentaries I watched last year. But this conversation, we talk about Vanderpump Rules. She was at the premiere a couple of weeks ago, so we get to talk about that. We talk about Salt Lake City a bunch, and then we get into cases. We talk a little bit about Scott Peterson, Ruby Frankie, a who's who of... I was about to say Batman villains, but no, not, it's just a who's who of people that keep popping up in pop culture these days, and that weird intersection between pop culture and true crime. So this is just a great conversation. I love her so much. We'll do a couple of stories before then, just to catch you up on what you need to know today. Oh, and also, I'm on Monday's episode of Brav Bros. We had a great time. Just a bunch of bad boys of podcasting, shooting the shit, No, so go check out that episode. I recorded with Amy Phillips on her Patreon today. Amy Phillips has a podcast called Drama Darling, and her Patreon is just tons of good stuff over there. I think that's going to be on her Patreon on Wednesday, but it was just a really delightful, funny conversation. I'm recording with Kate Casey for her show in a bit, Reality Life with Kate Casey. So, I'm there is, you have plenty of opportunities to listen to little old me. So, but I know each one of these have been great. So I'm really happy and proud to do any of these, with other, podcasters and creators. It's really actually special. But if you want to, leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, that always helps me out. And if you want to support even more, you can go to patreon.com/sobaditsgood. And, that'll be up. There's tons of stuff up over there. Okay, so yesterday I was talking to you guys about Nicki Minaj. So Nicki Minaj got into the weekend into a rap beef with Megan Thee Stallion, and she was threatening the release of this diss track, Bigfoot. Well, the track came out, and it was really, really bad. It was, you know, it was kind of her tweets that she had been tweeting maniacally all weekend set to an okay beat. And it was just lackluster. But it also shows you, like, she's still out there on Twitter saying how amazing it is because it charted on iTunes and all of this stuff. But, like, yeah, of course, your core fans are going to check this out. But it wasn't good. But, you know, the distortion reality feel for some people, you know, is just that you treat it like it's amazing. You treat it like it's a piece of gold. She's out there talking like it's legendary, and it's just not. It was really, really weak. And she was so pressed over the Megan Thee Stallion. And it's like Megan Thee Stallion hasn't even responded to any of this. It's like she's almost just letting Nicki kind of just be like a whirling dervish and wear herself out. Nicki Minaj did not need to do this. But I wanted to talk about the state of music and, you know, this really falls under pop culture and where we're at in terms of a society. So this is the iTunes top five chart. And it also ties in with a story I talked about yesterday in regards to Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears. Okay, so this is the top five in people buying songs on iTunes. Guess what number one is? Number one is Facts by featuring Ben Shapiro. Now, Ben Shapiro, obviously, you know, a political figure online, has YouTube, podcasting, all of this stuff, very right wing. It's him and a rapper named Tom McDonald. That is number one. That is the number one track on iTunes. It's Facts by Tom McDonald featuring Ben Shapiro. So that is number one on iTunes. The Ben Shapiro Nation has gone crazy. Now, number two is the Nicki Minaj diss track called Bigfoot. That is number two. And then number three is the song released on Thursday, Hiss, by Megan Thee Stallion, that kind of started this whole thing because she had two lines that didn't refer to Nicki Minaj by name, but had Megan's Law in the lyric, which then was taken to mean potentially Nicki Minaj's brother and husband, who are both sex offenders. I'm not making that up. And then number four, we have Selfish by Justin Timberlake, his new single. And then number five, we have the 2011 track by Britney Spears, Selfish, that her fans got right up there on the iTunes charts to compete with Justin Timberlake and say, how dare you do what you do, Justin Timberlake? So that is the top five in music on iTunes. Doesn't that blow your mind that three of those tracks are about fandoms or the artists themselves compete, like artists themselves mad about other artists. Like, so the Britney thing is charted because her fans are mad at Justin Timberlake, and some people say deservedly so. Nicki Minaj is charting because she has a diss track against Megan Thee Stallion. Megan Thee Stallion has a song that had two lines about Nicki Minaj, and, you know, the only two, and Ben Shapiro, can you really count that as music, since I think this is his first rap song? So the only one in the top five that actually has a real song not related to anybody or hating anyone is Justin Timberlake. The state of music. Okay, so this is also interesting in terms of Britney Spears. I was talking about this because I thought, you know, does Britney even really want to have beef with Justin Timberlake? How does she feel about everything? Well, she made her feelings known. She posted an Instagram with Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake doing one of his songs on the Jimmy Fallon show when they have the band in a tight little quarters. They're always kind of little cute videos. But this is what Britney Spears writes. I want to apologize for some of the things I wrote about in my book. If I offended any of the people I genuinely care about, I am deeply sorry. I also wanted to say I am in love with Justin Timberlake's new song, Selfish, rose emoji. It is so good. And how come every time I see Justin and Jimmy together, I laugh so hard? P.S. Sanctified is wow, too, which is his other song that was just released. So here is Britney Spears actually going, guys, it's okay. I'm okay with Justin. I like his music. It makes me smile. And I guess that's who we should be following our cues from, right? Or I don't know how you guys feel about it, but it's interesting that Britney Spears even went out of her way to say, it's okay, it's okay. And I think that's actually kind of a positive message overall, is that if Britney can, you know, can grow through this and be okay with this, I mean, and reclaim her narrative, and I think that's it, is that we don't have to be personally victimized our entire lives by people that wrong us, that we are stronger than that. And I mean, I think that's what Britney means by this, but who knows? It's also silly, right? So I thought that would actually, I don't know. So the top five, then you got Britney standing up for Justin. The world has officially gone mad. This is just, it's craziness. It is just craziness. Okay. Also, in terms of how crazy pop culture is these days, is, do you know the musical artist Charlie XCX? She's amazing pop. You know, go check her out if you haven't. She's been around for a minute, but she's always kind of, you know, she's mainstream, but also still holds a lot of respect underground. But get this, in terms of promotion, like we always talk about PR for celebrities, PR for actors, musicians, but this is something that she released of her PR team giving her ideas of how to go viral. And I thought this was insane. So here are ideas from her PR team to get her to go viral. This is not a joke. She released this. Here's one idea her PR team pitched her. Charlie gets her nipples pierced at Claire's Boutique. In fact, you know, Claire's Boutique, when I got an earring when I was in my junior year of high school, I got it done at Claire's, like a real man. So that was one idea. One idea is Charlie crashes drag brunches and lip syncs to her own songs across LA and New York City. And then they give alternative ideas within that idea. Charlie crashes weddings and sings her own songs. Charlie crashes a sweet 16 and sings. Charlie crashes a bat mitzvah and sings. Okay, here's another one. Charlie leaks a sex tape. Video playing lowly in the background. Night vision gradient camera style a la Midnight in Paris, which is the Paris Hilton sex tape. And then they go a Winona moment. They're referring to Winona Ryder. Charlie gets caught shoplifting at a mall and leaks the CCTV footage. Position it carefully so we, quote, steal from a brand Charlie is planning on collaborating with later on. So they would stage a shoplifting event of a brand that Charlie was promoting. That's an idea to get promotion, to get go viral. Charlie for president. Charlie announces she's running for office. And then there's one tube photo shoot in London. Have a full photo shoot in a packed tube car with multiple team members being as obnoxious as possible. And then the last one is full ball gown in the middle of the tube. Mental breakdown and pouting. So these are actual ideas from her PR to get attention. And I just think that's wild. But I want you to know that stuff exists, is that there are people out there paid to think of stupid ideas like this. Now, what makes it so stupid is that you want to believe that these ideas come from the artists themselves. If the artist is trying to promote themselves, you want it to come from their own insanity, their own artistic sensibility, their own sense of humor. You don't want it to be where there's a team of people trying to show how gritty and real an artist is. And that's why it's so frustrating. And it's, I think sometimes artists get a bad rap because this bullshit is out there. It's all this bullshit advertising day and age TikTok generation that we're in that is just trying to think of ways to sneak an advertisement in. So we don't get any real. We don't get any real in our reality because it's all people trying to game the system, game the algorithm to get in front of your eyes. And they want you to think, oh my God, it's so cool and so edgy, when the reality is a team of people have helped put this bullshit together. It's just so frustrating. It really, really frustrates me. But I wanted to tell you guys about that. I thought that was interesting. That just came out today. And then lastly today, I thought this was interesting in regards to Taylor Swift trying to make the Super Bowl, because she does have a concert in Japan the day before the Super Bowl. So a lot of people are doing think pieces. Will Taylor Swift be able to fly from Japan and make it in time for the Super Bowl in Las Vegas before kickoff? Now, this is the information we're getting. So Taylor Swift will perform in Japan the night before the Super Bowl. It will end around 10 p.m. Tokyo time, which is 5 a.m. Las Vegas time. And then the flight from Tokyo to Vegas takes 12 hours, meaning Taylor Swift can arrive at 5 p.m. local time in Vegas on the day before the Super Bowl, this person is saying, 25 hours and 35 minutes before kickoff. So she has plenty of time to get there, according to Darren Revelle online. I found this. So that's the information. Who knows? But also, imagine this. So Taylor is, you know, has her own jet. Like, how much does this cost to get to the Super Bowl? Like, what is it, like $250,000 to fly private? Like, how much money are you shelling out? Think about that next time you're supporting your wife or husband or girlfriend, boyfriend, whatnot, at some little, like, going to see him in, like, a community theater. I don't even know why I picked that. Like, going to support your loved ones. Think about this. Taylor Swift is shelling out hundreds of thousands of dollars to get to watch her dude play at the Super Bowl. So celebrity culture is so expensive, you guys. But that's it for our little pop culture intro, and let us get to an amazing guest. I hope you have fun with her. I love Emily D. Baker with a passion like a lot of us do, so enjoy this, folks. Make sure you're rating and reviewing, and check out Emily's stuff if you haven't, and I will talk to you bright and early on Wednesday for VPR Day, baby! What's going on, dude? It's me, Tom Sandoval! Let's rock and roll! Guys night!
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So, the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Folks, welcome back to So Bad It's Good, presented by Betches Media. Today, we have a legend. I mean, truly somebody that I look forward to talking to every chance I can get. When I bumped into her at BravoCon, it was like parting a sea of people that kept coming up to her going, "Are you the one and the only Emily D. Baker?" And she would say yes. And then she'd be like, "And this is Ryan. This is Ryan from So Bad It's Good." And they're like, yeah. Oh, hey, Emily. But regardless, Emily D. Baker is the internet's go-to legal analyst. Now, she has close to 750,000 subscribers on YouTube, but what you might not know is she also has an amazingly successful podcast called The Emily Show. If you're just looking for the audio version of her insanely precise and brilliant opinions. So without further ado, we're going to talk Bravo. Don't worry, because she actually is one of the bigger Bravo heads I know, and I don't think she gets enough of an opportunity to do that, but we'll dip into some legalese as well. So ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Emily D. Baker. Emily.
Oh, Brian, you're so kind. It's so good to see you, and I don't get enough opportunities to talk Bravo. When the Scandoval went down and there was a restraining order, my audience is like, "Why are we talking about a restraining order?" I'm like, "Because it's legal. It's a tie-in. I get to talk about Vanderpump Rules."
It has now reached my territory where I can talk about one of my true loves. You mentioned Vanderpump Rules because we have the new season premiering this week, the season 11, and you were just at the Vanderpump Rules premiere party in Los Angeles. I was supposed to go to that, and I thought I had COVID. I got so scared, and my dad had been in town, and I was like, "Oh my God, I gave my dad COVID. I was so freaked out." And luckily it was just normal, my body breaking down. But you actually went to this premiere party. What was it like?
It was really fun. I was texting you from the car because it took me an hour and a half to go 8 miles. And I was worried that my hair had completely undone itself. Like, these are the stressors of trying to get anywhere in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I grew up in LA. I lived in LA for over 40 years. And then when I moved, magically, it erased from my brain exactly how long things can take to get, especially towards Hollywood. So getting there was an adventure. But once we got there, it was a really lovely room. The room was set up almost like the BravoCon seating areas, where they had really comfortable couches and chairs and tables for each of the cast members in a roped off area and for their family and friends. So there were really couches and chairs and tables for all the cast around the stage where the giant screen was to see the premiere. And then those who had bought tickets had access to a bar and lovely seating areas as well, just to the side of where the cast, friends and family were seated. And the room was not packed by any means. It was really easy to mingle. It was not full at all.
I mean, I thought they were going to pack that thing to the gills. So I was imagining, because I've seen so many concerts at the Palladium when you're just packed in there like canned tuna. So I thought that's what it was going to be like. So when I saw the pictures of these lovely couches and it looked like there was so much breathing room, and I was like, wow, this is like a really, they did this as a really classy event. What were your interactions with the Vanderpump Rules cast? Because I have to imagine at this point, a lot of the cast probably know you.
Some of the cast do, and I've met some of the cast through mutual friends over time and at BravoCon, and same with some of the team at Bravo, who I've gotten to meet over at BravoCon and then through content. So it was lovely to see some familiar faces. It was more fun for me to watch the interactions, because after the screening aired, the rope line was very low to the ground. So people were just stepping over it to come in and talk to the cast. I imagine that'll be different if they ever do this again, but they made the cast much more accessible than even at a BravoCon, because there were less people. And there was one interaction with a fan who had been at the bar, because the bar had no line, unlike BravoCon. And so James Kennedy was engaging with this fan. Allie was standing right with him. And then he's a fairly tall guy. And this fan like went up on tippy toes to try to kiss him. And he was like pulling away as hard as he could. And he's
No, it's guy's night. Guy's night.
And it was just, it was some of those little awkward interactions. Some of the interactions were very chill. And some of the super fans were meeting the cast for the first time. Some of the cast dipped out very, very quickly after the premiere aired.
Now, when you say dipped out, the person who coined dipped out was Tom Sandoval. Did Tom Sandoval dip out?
He dipped out not as early as Ken and Lisa, who were surrounded by security as they were kind of guided through the Palladium to leave out the back very shortly after the premiere ended. I saw Ariana leave pretty early in there. Tom and Tom stayed a little while, but they had posted on social media that they were hosting some kind
Shorts
of after party. Tom. It's Shorts and Sandies. I'm like, whatever restaurant they own. So they left to go to that, and we're kind of going around and telling people to go and leave and go to that. I did not leave and go to Shorts and Sandies. It seemed that some of the Bravo fans were torn about loyalty and whether or not that was a problem.
See, Emily, you bring up this amazing thing that going into this 11th season, that's where I think a lot of our, where we lie of like, can you have a redemption season this soon after the actual event, and the actual event being something that really kind of, I mean, I was about to say touched the hearts and minds, but like really spread like wildfire, made national news. And that's the thing. And after seeing the first episode, where do you tend to lie in terms of how we're going to treat Tom Sandoval during this season and potentially after?
I don't know. I believe that it being on reality team is such a weird, or reality TV is such a weird thing, right? Because a life that might otherwise play out privately is playing out on TV, and everyone has an opinion on it. I think what Tom did to Ariana with Raquel in the jacuzzi was horrible.
Did you know Tom Sandoval was in a jacuzzi with Raquel? I didn't know that. I can't believe that.
Well, Ariana was away as well. So iconic. But this is a cast, and this is where I'm really torn on it. This is a cast that is regularly cheated on one another with everyone involved in the cast. And so I think Tom Sandoval going into this cheating scandal was like, but I was kind of dating Kristen when I met Ariana, and like, Kristen slept with Jax, and like everyone in this cast has had those moments. I don't think he understood that after a 9-year relationship where you own a house together and are partners, it is different than when you've dated somebody for a year or two. And I don't think he anticipated the national attention this would get and how jilted the nation feels by Tom Sandoval. That said, he cheated on his partner. Should he be able to continue to live his life? Yes. Are you going to lose some of your friend group? Probably. Are you going to lose some audience loyalty? Probably. Is he going to take any responsibility for it? I don't know. I keep seeing, and from Special Forces and other shows, I keep seeing him feel very sorry for himself about how this all played out. And I don't think that's a redemption arc. Even rewatching Vanderpump last season, when he's explaining why he's cheating, he's blaming Ariana for his own choices. And if he doesn't shift that, there's not going to be a lot of love lost there with an audience that really doesn't want to be seen to support him. And by way of supporting him, supporting Tom Schwartz as well, because Schwartz presumably knew this was going on because a lot of it was going down at his house. He was providing, like, he was aiding and abetting infidelity.
No, by the way, this really falls into your purview because you actually brought up something so great. You brought up something so great is that Tom, thinking about this, didn't think about the details. And what we know about legal cases, it's all about the details. It's all about these things of what you can prove, what actually happened, but what you can prove, and all of these things and all of these details coming out. And also the other interesting thing you brought up is terms of getting older. Is that you're not in your 20s anymore when that kind of shit would fly. So I think that thing of a lot of people, myself included, felt, let down because we thought we were watching somebody grow into this kind of matureness and something that I thought was very different than other men on Vanderpump Rules. And then to realize, like, listen, I already know my faults. I thought Tom was better than all of us. I thought Tom was kind of this bright, shining hope for men. And it turns out he was just like the rest of us. And that was disappointing. But also you nail it with saying, you know, there still seems to be this underlying anger at Ariana.
Yes.
When this was done to Ariana, and until he can reconcile that, you're right. I don't know if there's ever true redemption.
No, I think there's going to be a lot of hate watching and the internet pointing out every time Tom is like, well, I felt like the relationship wasn't enough. Okay, did you talk to your partner about that? Did you go to couples therapy about that? Or did you just go look for affection and attention elsewhere, which seems to be what he did. He treated this entire situation like he was a 20-year-old when life had become much more real than that and clearly had become very real to Ariana. And I think a lot of people, as they get into their 40s, whether it's happened to themselves or their friends, have watched people's lives blow up because somebody is like, I'm not getting the attention that I need or want, and fails to communicate that with the people in their life and blows up their life. And I think everybody has a tremendous amount of empathy for Ariana in that, because he made a decision to blow up their life and she has no part in that and no control of what he's doing in that. And so whether there's a redemption arc this soon or not, I don't know how there can be. I just want to see what plays out with the house and the lawyers. Like, how are they still living together?
Well, that's in your purview. The house.
So excited about it.
Ariana had to sue Tom Sandoval to almost force, because she wasn't getting a proper offer from Tom for Tom to buy out her portion of the house that they own together. And from what my understanding is that she had to kind of make that move to kind of force his hand. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So because the two aren't legally married, there isn't a divorce when the relationship dissolves. Normally, joint assets and communal assets will go into a divorce and a judge will divide them up. Because there's not going to be a formal divorce proceeding, there needs to be a way to divide this house. Each of them own part of the house. So each of them have their own ownership interest in 50% of a house. However, it's really hard to sell 50% of a house. So if Ariana wanted to sell, who wants to buy 50% of a house where Tom Sandoval owns the other 50%, unless it's like Schwartz? Schwartz, maybe you should just buy it 50-50.
I mean, kind of, yeah.
I mean, just go buy Ariana out. Maybe Schwartz needs to buy Ariana out, and then he can go live with Sandoval in the Valley or whatever. But if they can't give her an offer to buy her out, she can't go sell that interest in a single family home to anyone else. And she can't sell the house if he doesn't agree to sell, because they both own it 50-50 and they have to agree on what's going to happen. So she took it to court and said to the judge, make this house get sold. make this sell and we'll split the proceeds. Probably not 50-50 based on the show and conversations on the show. It seems that Tom took a bit of equity out of the house to
open the
fund Schwartz and Sandys, right? So it could be the situation where he can't actually offer Ariana a fair market price to buy her out of the house. So if the house sells, she'll walk away with her 50% and he'll walk away with nothing because the debt will have to get paid for any mortgage that he took out on his share of the equity. But because they own it 50-50, he should not have been able to tap into her share of the equity in the house, which might be his concern truly, is that she'll walk away with a sum of money to go buy another property or rent and he'll walk away with nothing. And not be able, LA is not inexpensive. And first and last month rent and coming up with the money you need to find a new place might be one of his biggest concerns, where paying his half of the mortgage might be somewhat easy for him. But maybe you should have thought about that.
Why, for Ariana, why get that lawyer involved? Why get that of like paying somebody else to actually force this? Is that a necessary move for Ariana to actually get this process finished?
It seems that Tom refuses to sell and that he will not pay her out fair market value to what she believes the house is worth. So there's no other option other than to both stay. If he won't buy her out at a fair market value, I don't know what her other option is. I wouldn't want him keeping my money either, Ryan. I'd be like,
no, I
pay 50% of this house. You give me what I'm owed and the house is probably appreciated. And I wonder if there's a little celebrity bump to that house too, right?
Oh,
little infamy.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, and everything's like so specifically decorated. It is, I've been in that house. It is so, the wallpaper is so specific. Everything is so done down to like the final, even like the outside fire pit area, which he was telling me once about how much he put into that fire pit. And it is wild, but at the same time, you put yourself in this situation and now Ariana needs to get out of this situation. That's the only thing, the fair thing. Yeah. But also I think in Tom's head, I feel like this is just me thinking this, if like there's a bit of, well, listen, you're doing well now because of this. Why do I, like, can't you do me a favor? And like, I almost feel like, look, you are making so much money because of something that I caused. I wonder if there's anything like that adding to all of this, is how well she's doing, making him even more angry.
I mean, I guess it's possible to have those feelings and to stick his heels in the mud and be like, nah, I'm not selling the house because it's the only thing he can really do to her more at this point. But truly, hasn't he done enough? I think she would rather have not been cheated on publicly, because it really seemed to me, and again, I don't know Tom and Ariana from anybody. I've seen them in person a handful of times at events. I'm not friends with them, but it seems that Ariana was trying to build a life with Tom. And Tom, I still worry, was trying to build a brand with Ariana. And I just wonder how much that is true. And she's like, I built my life in this house. And he's like, I built my brand with you, that we were Tom and Ariana. And so he's not seeing the big deal moving on. It feels very like content house breakup.
And that's TikTok weird house. To me. It's a TikTok
house. It is. So, and no, Ariana was living real life.
When sweet tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like sweet tarts twisted rainbow ropes, gummies fruity splits, and chewy fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet tarts, dare to combine. Visit sweettartscandy.com to shop now.
Yeah, well, sometimes I feel with certain, a lot, like the majority of reality people, I feel like they're frozen, like it's arrested development from the time they get on the show. That's where their maturity stops and they never truly grow past that. And we're seeing that here. The other thing I, you know, you always mention, like, you know, we have to go by what we see. We have to go by the information presented to us and what the show presents to us and the story the producers are trying to tell us. But if you collect all of this information from season 10 and the Howie Mandel podcast Tom did and Rachel's podcast that is now out there providing more information, I was thinking about in terms of like murder cases, or I was even going back to OJ, of almost trying to engineer the results you wanted after the fact, of like trying to present Ariana as this shrew, somebody that didn't buy pins and batteries, somebody like to add up to the outcome that you did, like almost trying to like, okay, I cheated and potentially he cheated just because he wanted to like hook up with somebody else. He wanted to have somebody fascinated with him. But then he was like, oh, shit, I have to provide all of these reasons why. So I feel like he reverse engineered a lot of those reasons to try to present this defense of Tom Sandoval.
I think Tom was leaning into the fact that society often blames women when there is a cheating scandal and the men get off a little bit easier. And he thought that maybe he could engineer that because, again, when he cheated on Kristen, it seems, with Ariana, everybody was like, well, Kristen is awful. Like this and this and that. Like the fans had no love for Kristen. I think Tom thought that's how it was going to go down. What he didn't realize is that not only have times changed, but also that his laying the little like crumbs on the show that their relationship had gone a way that he didn't want it to. And he felt like he wasn't getting the attention he needed. People were going to hold him accountable for that, to talk to his partner, not to just talk to Tom about it. And
or talk to us about it.
Exactly. He wasn't anticipating that. And he wasn't anticipating how obvious I think the breadcrumbs were. He's trying to justify man-child behavior, and it wasn't flying with anyone. He's truly too old to be pulling that shit. And that's where people weren't rallying around him and being like, oh, poor you, Tom, you had to contribute equally to your household. Oh, that must be hard for you to miss me with it.
Well, and also, I mean, he's given no real time for kind of self-reflection or even catching up to what he's done, because he immediately went out on tour. He did Special Forces. They started filming this show, which Vanderpump Rules, he was doing Special Forces when they started kind of filming this show. And he's just kept out there in the press. Like, he has kept his foot on the gas instead of actually braking. And like, this is not a Rachel fan podcast by any means, but I do find it interesting that she had to go ship herself off for 3 months and actually look at her behavior in hopes to stop that sort of behavior. And I'm not giving her any kind of kudos or awards, but it's very different path than Tom Sandoval went.
Absolutely. And I wonder how much Tom is like, all attention's good attention, strike while the iron's hot, do what we can do. Where Rachel was like, this is going to mentally destroy me. The entire world feels like it's against me. I made a bad decision. Normally those things aren't amplified quite so much. But at the end of the day, Rachel was friends with Ariana and should not have violated that friendship. Tom was in the partnership with Ariana, and I think should be held more responsible for that, because he is the one that was in a partnership. Should you do that to your friends? No. But Tom was building a life with Ariana. Rachel wasn't.
Completely. And one more thing before we get to Salt Lake is that, you know, you mentioned how, you know, almost benefiting from how we treat women in this world in a sense. And it reminds me of your amazing coverage from the Johnny Depp Amber Heard stuff. And we're not getting into this, obviously, but Amber Heard, I mean, really, I've read the most, you know, insane, horrible things about Amber Heard. And I would imagine with Ariana, at the end of the day, she just didn't want to be cheated on. But if she did, of course, she's going to take these opportunities given. Do you have any kind of suspicions of how and if we're going to turn on Ariana this season? Because even Ariana said in a comment, like, we'll see how it goes. I'm preparing for people to be against me at some point, because I almost think women expect that from the outside world.
I hope not, because I don't think Ariana's done anything other than say, this is a terrible situation, but there's all this attention and people are going to be profiting on it, and I'm going to rebuild my life. And I think Ariana's rebuilding her life in a way where she might be able to be out of the spotlight at some point in the future. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Duracell is going to do an ad poking at the cultural moment of Vanderpump Rules. Why wouldn't she say yes to being in it? You know, if you're getting like Uber Eats doing a ad, or DoorDash doing an ad where it's, you know, good as gold or whatever, poking at this cultural moment, why wouldn't you benefit from that? Because everyone is going to take a moment to benefit from it. And I think she absolutely should have.
Yeah.
And I hope that people don't turn on her for that, because I think it would be tremendously unfair for that to happen. That's not to say people aren't tremendously unfair on the internet, and we can see that in other cases. But most of the time, there's action on the part of the person that gets turned on, where when it comes to Ariana, the only action was trying to pick up the pieces of Tom Sandoval and Rachel's decisions. And again, not that I'm saying Rachel's free from blame in all of this earlier, but I think that she's been held almost, her feet have been held to the fire almost more than Tom. And I do think that that's unfair. I think Tom needs to be held more responsible and equally responsible as Rachel.
Yeah, I need Tom to write a book, If I Did It, like OJ. If I Did It.
Oh, God. I mean, it's, I think he thought that he could still get away with 20-year-old fuckboy behavior. Apologies if we don't curse on this show.
No, but please, we do.
That's great. But that's what he was doing. And they thought it would, I think they all thought it would be cute and it would be fine. And people would be like, oh yeah, Tom, poor you, Ariana,
yeah.
You know, your partner is struggling and she's had a lot of really hard grief moments in her personal life. And so she wasn't paying 100% attention to you. And instead of showing up and being there for her, he thought everyone was going to pat him on the back and be like, oh, we understand, Tom. No. That's not what happened at all.
But interesting for a certain segment of the audience, you know, he'll still be able to hook up with. I'm sure girls were even so excited to see him that night at the Palladium, because at the end of the day, he still is a TV or a reality TV star. And that does hold a weird cachet with people still.
I wonder what that's like when he's out without the other cast there, because there were definitely dividing lines. And you could see that even with the fans, people weren't as ready to interact with him as they were with like James and Lala and Katie and the rest of the cast. The Toms were a little bit on an island, it seems. And then Ken and Lisa are always kind of on an island just because they're Ken and Lisa.
I know. But
the Toms are a little bit on an island with the groups that they were there with. And I think we're going to see that play out this season too, because the cast is going to have to figure out how to be friends with them. And if you rebuild a friendship with either of the Toms, are you then on the outs with Ariana, Katie, Lala, and the rest of the cast, or not?
Ariana said that, when it first happened, Ariana said, even to Tom Schwartz on that last episode, listen, if you're going to, I can't be friends with you. And that's a very clear boundary. And we're supposed to set boundaries for yourself. You can't blame Ariana for that. Lala set that boundary with Schwartz last season in regards to playing pickleball with Randall. And then she went back on it, but it'll be interesting to see where everybody, and in the first episode, you start to see those cracks kind of to form. So it'll be interesting. Now, Real Housewives of Salt Lake City coming off an insanely good season that is just mind-blowing. What did you think of last night's reunion, and I guess the three-part reunion? Because for me, it just didn't – you're never going to get past how good that finale was. And we're never going to get all the answers that we need, that we feel like we need. So how did you feel? And then we'll throw into the Monica of it all not coming back.
I felt like every court reporter that has ever yelled at me for talking too fast or talking over someone. In my brain, I was sitting there the entire end of the finale going, stop over talking each other. And I am an interrupter and I get it. But in a finale with Andy sitting there looking like, what am I going to do with these women? And they are just screaming over each other. It's going to take me another couple watches to hear everything that they said to each other, because they were just screaming at one another across the couches. And that was difficult to listen to. I don't think we got a lot of answers. I'm still not 100% in on Heather Gay's story about the black eye. And
Well, what story? She didn't give us a story.
Which one?
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying we still don't know. Like, how do you wake up and assume you got it from Jen Shaw? Why would you assume that?
Correct.
Like, I still don't know details. Even with the, audio that they showed us, she's like, she remembered that. She was like, okay, this is what I'm saying. This is what she's saying. But why did you wake up thinking it must be Jen Shaw? Because when I'm blackout, or I've been like, I've fallen. I mean, I've had a falling incident where I didn't wake up thinking it was somebody that pushed me down. I realized oh my God. Like, why would you immediately think it was Jen Shaw? Like, what is the story there? And why we didn't get any story.
I felt so misled, because when we saw the previews of Heather and her hands going, well, I thought we were going to get a timeline, receipts, screenshots,
yes,
proof. I thought there was going to be some evidence. And it was the two of them talking and Heather going, she said this to me. Really? That's it? That's the description? It was like, oh, we were drinking and things happened. That's not a description of anything. So it was very strange. And watching Heather this season has reminded me, you've seen the movie Wild Things a million years ago.
Yeah.
Neve Campbell, Denise Richards.
Bill Murray, yeah.
Yes, such a great movie. But Heather Gay, I'm waiting for her to get on the sailboat and like off into the sunset. Like, she's orchestrated the whole thing. And now she's the top bitch of Salt Lake City. Like, what is even happening here?
I was reading this fantastic article by Kate Arthur and then a video for Variety did with Heather Gay. And I do want to remind people, and I try to remind the audiences, I used to really just ride hard for Heather Gay. But I will say, Heather comes from a place of, you want to talk about fans? You want to talk about fans of Housewives? She was one of the biggest fans of Housewives out there before she got onto Salt Lake City. So you have to remember that. I remember interviewing her on my show, and her one of her favorite Housewives, she said, was Lisa Rinna. If that kind of puts anything like, so Lisa Rinna was also a very calculated housewife at times. She played it until the last season decently well. And I think Heather is very aware of all of this. And that's the thing, is that you have to really, you either buy her story hook, line, and sinker, or you have to realize she knows that what's at play right now. And I believe there's a little bit, and I'm a little bit of a performance here. And I don't want to say that in a bad way, because she has every right to do what she's doing, but it smacks of a little bit of dishonesty when she's lied for the last 3 years. The verbiage she used last night was saying, woke up, I said to Jen, even before Jen asked her, that I would cover for her. And that blew me away, because we're supposed to, she's like, I've been covering for her for 3 years. And that really opened up everything for me even more of like, first off, why? We've never gotten the real why of covering for somebody for 3 years. How much did Heather Gay know? When did she know it? It just made so many more questions instead of answering any answers.
And Heather, you know, Heather ages ago had taken down that podcast episode where she was questioning Jen Shah about her business. Like, once stuff started coming to light about Jen Shah's business, Heather took that podcast episode down with a swiftness. Like, there are questions still lingering for me when she talks about how afraid of Jen Shah she is that we just don't know. And so it did. It left a lot of questions. And the Variety interview, when did they record that? Like, well, they didn't do it yesterday.
I know for a fact they didn't. And by the way, and I think you would, you know, I had said I'd heard that Monica was not coming back. I had a good source, and I think a lot of us had heard similar things. Yes. And, you know, we finally got the, but what was so interesting was the fan reaction. And then towards the end of the day, you had this, well, you never know. Like, a producer goes, you never know. Like, maybe she will come back. It was like, almost like they were like, kind of not reversing course, but they were like, well, they just need a cool down period with Monica. Do you think it's a mistake for Monica to not come back episode one, season five?
I think it is absolutely a mistake, but I don't know how production makes those decisions in the moment, depending on what the cast is saying. And I think that's a difficult thing to navigate. Do you recast the entire show and have it just be Monica and nobody else? Because I don't think that will work. Or do you go half a season and then go to the cast and be like, hey guys, so we're putting together this season. Ratings are going to be trash. We've got nothing going on. Monica's coming to lunch, and then bring her in with one of the other women and have them sit down for a lunch. Whether that's Mary coming back and Mary, I loved the like Mary Monica relationship that was building this season. I wanted to see more of that.
Well, I'm curious if Mary's done now too, because I feel like if they brought Mary back, that's as somebody to hang out with Monica.
Yes, absolutely. And which will be very interesting, I think, to see. I don't know if they need a cool down period. It's just in the scope of everything we've seen on Housewives, I feel like the level of outrage and betrayal that they are portraying, I don't quite understand. And I know they keep trying to explain why they feel so betrayed.
Yeah.
But I'm also having a hard time understanding when this is kind of the chess of Housewives that was going on with this account. And maybe I've missed it, but I saw that account going really hard for Jen
Shah.
And not really hard for the other women. And even when Heather was like, you know, the Reality Von T's account said these things about me, they were repeating things Jen said and highlighting things that Jen had said. So
I can name five accounts that went harder on those ladies than Reality Von T's. I can name five, like I can literally name five that they should be more scared of at that time than Reality Von T's. And I don't want to I'm not saying that Monica is like, obviously there's a lot of really interesting, potentially weird behavior, but also I think the show did a really decent job about showing the context of why she is the way she is a little bit. But yeah, yep. Driving past the house is, yeah, that's wild. It comes off potentially stalkerish. But I will tell you, being
LA
in the Bravo-
bus tours. Yeah, LA well, sells bus tours saying. To drive through celebrity
LA,
houses.
Go on a Facebook group on Bravo. They literally drive past Jax's house on a daily basis. Are you kidding me? Like, that's just what... But also, all of those people started off as a fan at some point. Like, you've got to get away. At this point, you're going to be hard-pressed in the year 2024 for any lady to not know what Housewives is. And yes, of course, right. Dream casting is for rich ladies that do not need television and that just happen to be real on TV. That is like lightning in a bottle, I feel, at this point, because it is so popular. And yes, people try to get on this show like they try to get on SNL. Like the audition process, Jennifer Aiden, you can go back to anybody trying to get on this show. We've got to start living in reality if we're supposed to be a reality show.
And I just think that the dream casting days of like a Kathy Hilton, of somebody who is uber wealthy, entertaining, and doesn't need the show.
Yeah.
Most people who live that life are not going to open themselves up to the downsides of being on reality TV because it's just not worth it. We saw Whitney Rose's husband lose his job because of the TV show. We've seen the downsides of social media because of the TV show. And who, like, there has to be someone in that in between that will benefit from the show. Cause if you're really not benefiting from the show, I don't know why you would open yourself up for it. And I think when Real Housewives started, it was a completely different dynamic. Yep. When you started opening up the gates of Kodo to see what these women's lives were like and seeing some of them pick up from divorces and some of them living uber wealthy in this gated community. And then you've pulled into New Jersey with this friend group, and some of them are related, and these two are sisters and they married brothers, and wow, that's weird. And there's flipping tables and New Jersey dramatics, but the world has changed and reality TV has changed and the show's evolving with it. So to think you're going to get someone who's not strategizing to get on the show.
Yeah.
Most new castmates have strategized to get in the show, not quite in this way, but I think what Monica was trying to point out is that all of these women were in the DMs of the Reality Vontees account, feeding information about other women on the show as well, and saying things about what was being posted. So she was trying to say, you're being hypocritical. It's a back and forth. You're happy for us to share the information, so you're one step removed from the information, but you're still playing the same chess game that I'm playing. And I think Monica, when they're like, you're this, she's like, yeah, I'm part of it.
Well, after watching Watch What Happens Live last night with Heather too, you know, I got the sense, man, she's still protecting Jen Shah. She was able to vanquish Monica, who actually, you know, by the way, I don't believe she's like, you know, Peter Pan or, you know, Robin Hood, Robin. Like, I don't believe there was like altruistic notions, but I believe she was a horrible boss and she was a horrible person. And we've seen this time and time again. And her employees wanted to take her down. The thing that I keep, if they can prove, this was my big question. If they can prove that Monica was the person putting those financial documents about Angie Katsanavis, then I think we're in a different territory, because then it's like, oh, you actively are on the show trying to take a cast member down that is not Jen Shah. That to me, and by the way, there's
different.
A good chance that Monica did do that, but I'm so confused even with the Meredith Monica of it all. And at this point, if Monica's a quote unquote proven liar, you know, there's always going to be suspicion with Monica. So sometimes I understand why she cannot continue right now. But at the same time, I feel like we've seen worse. I feel like all those housewives have finstas. And I think Heather Gay is turned out to be the stronger storyteller. Just like we were talking about with Sandoval,
yes,
not being able to communicate a story. Heather Gay told a brilliant story on the finale. I mean, brilliant, putting it together at the last minute, supposedly. And I think she did a decent job at the reunion of putting things away from the black eye, or using it as the fulcrum to say, this show is about sisterhood. This show is about friendship. And you have to really, like, I understand it, but the show, like, let's stop pretending those core four love each other so dearly.
It's interesting because I don't know how much we see of them on each other's socials when the show's not filming in Salt Lake. It's just not, and I don't think any of us necessarily expect it. We're like, these are women that live in the same area navigating or trying to navigate friendships, but it's friendships through the lens of reality TV. That's not a authentic situation at all. And Bravo, the fourth wall is gone with Bravo, and it has been with social media, because half of the storylines are now, you said this on this podcast, you retweeted that on Twitter, you liked this shady tweet.
Yep.
Half of the show is over stuff that happens off of the show on social media, which is why I love shows like yours, because it keeps me in the loop on what all those things are that are going off on social media that are going to become next season's plot line.
Yeah.
But yes, Heather served this up on a silver platter. I don't think she found out about it at the last moment while they're on this trip. I don't believe that for a single second. It's too coincidental to be a coincidence, and it's not. But the timing was brilliant, and it was housewife chess. And I don't think Heather wanted Monica on the show anymore. I don't know if the other women felt as strongly about it, but Monica
Lisa seemed to be very strong. Yes. And by the way, Heather had obviously presented.
I forgot anything Lisa had said this season.
Heather obviously had built her case because Lisa knew about every audio that Heather was going to play. And yes. Meredith kind of, by the way, I forgot Meredith was there in the third part of the reunion at times because she kept so quiet, almost like she spent her whole wad in Palm Springs when she was like, you can leave. And then she was quiet for the rest of the season, except for fighting with Lisa Barlow. But like, are we supposed to forget once again, Lisa Barlow completely attacking Meredith Marks in Bermuda about lying? Like, I know you did this with Angie K. Like, that's why I don't know if that We Are a Core Four sisterhood of friends. It really holds a lot of weight for me because I've heard them say
she
the worst
her
things.
A garbage whore last season.
She effed half of New York. Her and her fake closing family.
And Heather being mad that Monica lied after she's like, oh, and by the way, I've lied to all of you for seasons. Like, if Jen Shaw is truly punching cast members, then you're putting the rest of the cast at risk if somebody's going hands-on with other cast members when they're drinking. To not say anything about that truly does actually put your other cast members at risk. But instead, she doesn't say anything and what throws production under the bus? Come on. Come on. I just can't. I can't with any of it. I understand that they are hurt, but I don't think that's something that can't be talked through. And maybe Monica just didn't talk it through with them well enough saying, I felt like I was the outsider and I wanted to be part of this world and bring the Gossip Girl storyline back full circle.
Well, that's what I thought, too, is that I thought she had a really great opportunity to present a case that she didn't present. And I think almost, and I know this is part of her style, but coming in with every line of like, you bitch, shut up. Like, I think that kind of knocks her out at the knees immediately. And so she wasn't really able to present a case, nor did she apologize. So from a legal analyst's mind, if this were a case, how would you rate Monica's performance about trying to cut through all of that noise?
Monica doubled down when she needed to apologize, and she was owning it, but also doubling down on it, which was hard. Where if she had owned it and said, yes, I started this account because we had this toxic boss and we saw no other way to let the public know how bad it was before this indictment. And we didn't know what else to do. Y'all have a platform and a voice, and we felt voiceless and we felt abused and we felt that this employer needed to be exposed because everybody's like cheering her on reality TV. And that burned us up. So we wanted the world to know. And sometimes things were said about the other ladies and it got out of my control. There were six of us. I couldn't control what everybody did, but I genuinely wanted to be on this show to pick up the pieces of the damage Jen Shaw did because I felt a kinship to y'all because you have seen that damage firsthand with what Jen Shaw did. And I don't know anyone else that's experienced that the way I've experienced it. And I thought that there would be some friendship here for all of us that have gone through like the Jen Shaw cyclone. And I don't know who else to turn to. I imagine it's a weird and insular world when all that flips upside down on you, not different than being a content creator. There's people in my real life who are like, what you do is weird. I have no idea. But then when other content creators get to chat, there's a different level of chat because we all understand how weird this world is that we're in. And I think Monica was looking for that and did not articulate that well.
Yeah, not at all. And I felt like it was such a missed opportunity. But also, I just feel like this whole season has been like David Lynchian. Like I sometimes every time, like even Whitney saying at the Whitney going like, Andy's like, where are you leaving off, Whitney? She's like, I don't know. I think it's very great. But she's like, at the end of the day, I don't know if I can trust. And I almost thought she was going to say, just the situation, but she's like, Monica. But I was like, what about Heather sitting there and lying to you? And also, I believe Heather always talks down to Whitney anyways. And anytime Heather starts to even messed up, Whitney runs over and comforts her. She's always the first person to comfort Heather. And I think that relationship is so interesting to look at. But I thought Whitney was going to be even like, well, now I'm going to give it time and think about it, instead of saying, I still don't trust Monica. I feel like either we don't know a huge piece of information, and I'm like, at the end of the day, I'm just still left with so many questions, even though they're trying to banish and vanquish Jen Shaw for good. I feel like maybe we need to look a little bit more here, because it feels like something happened with all of the like Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants style, that they all like murdered somebody together and like won't say like they will. They're going to take this to the death, because I truly at this point don't understand. As a legal expert as well, Jen Shaw is making comments through a representative from prison about saying Heather Gay is a liar. I never did this. I never did this. And I do wonder, just in terms of like prison behavior, it can't help if you're like up for parole at some point, if she's still engaging in housewife behavior from behind bars.
I don't know how much it's going to hurt her, truly. She's clearly watching the shows. She's allowed to do so. She's allowed to make phone calls out. There's nothing in her conditions that say that that information can't then be reposted and shared by someone else. She's not the one on the phone with social media saying those things. If she were, then that could be a problem. But we're seeing this with other reality stars too. Todd Chrisley has been quite chatty from behind bars as well. So I don't know if this behavior shows that she's not learning from the things that she has done. But I do see her very much trying to still defend her name and her reputation, which is what we saw so much from her on the show. But it's so, the Jen Shaw effect on Salt Lake City is not going anywhere soon. And we saw this at that first BravoCon in New York, when Jen Shaw showed up and crashed the party at the Ganzevoort. There's people like drawn to her, and there's people on the cast that don't want to be drawn to her. And she's incredibly charismatic, which so many defendants who engage in fraud are very charismatic. And the show can't stop talking about her. It's like the friend group that can't stop talking about that one guy in high school every time they get together. Like every time they get together, they have to talk about Jen Shaw. And next season, they're going to talk about Jen Shaw in absentia and Monica in absentia. That's all they're going to talk about, is these women that aren't there. So they're still going to have a huge presence on the show.
Yeah. No,
whether they're participating or not.
But you're right. I mean, there must be this charisma about Jen Shaw, where you have all of these four strong women on stage saying, listen, she's just this charismatic. We were all we were put in prisons through Jen Shaw and her behavior. And I just find it interesting also to Heather going like, well, I woke up and I am a new person through all of this. I have now had the strength. And I'm like, wait a sec. And if you read Heather Gay's book, which I did, like, she's been a strong person most of her life. So part of me is like, you can't blame somebody for something that you really wanted to be at. Like, she courted Jen Shaw in a way. This was a mutual two-way street. And it does worry me that she presents it in this certain light of kind of like a phoenix rising from these ashes of finally finding confidence. And I just don't know if I buy into that story. But Jen Shaw, I mean, people put so much on her, but it's interesting when we watch her on the show, I never was enraptured by Jen Shaw. I was never like, oh my God, I live and die by everything that she says.
I was mesmerized by the things that came out of her mouth. I was like, who says that? When she's like screaming at Mary, I'm like, you said that on TV. Like, your husband's a coach at a public university. This is why I would be terrible on reality TV, because people would be like, what do you really think? I'm like, I don't know. I'm not screaming at people is whether or not they're banging their grandpa. Like, it takes a different kind of unfiltered, regardless of the consequences, to be on reality TV in the way that Jen Shaw was. And it was fascinating for me to watch, like, how do you just go there every single time? She was giving Housewife. It seemed that Jen Shaw was inspired by Teresa Giudice and was going to be the Teresa Giudice of Salt Lake City, and has fulfilled that in more ways than one.
Yeah. I mean, seriously. I mean, that's why, you know, the Emily Show, your podcast, and Emily D. Baker on YouTube, I think it's so huge. I mean, because you're brilliant, obviously, but also you walk us through the behind the scenes stuff. And as I, I walk through Salt Lake City or any of these shows now, I think the more we're interested in as an audience is the behind the scenes stuff of how producers are approaching these things. You start to think about it like court cases. And there's this weird intersection that I always talk about with pop culture and true crime now, where it's like, how as a producer do you put together this season? They said they're having hundreds of conversations about Monica, about all of this. You know, what is the vetting process if they didn't know about Reality Von T's? You know, like they obviously, you know, I read in interviews of like, oh, we put together that she worked with Jen like a couple months in. But I was like, wait a sec, there's a scene in the first episode. There's a first scene in the first episode with Lisa Barlow where Lisa's like, oh, my God, I remember you. Yes. At the airport for Jen. So like, wait, how is it months in when that was the first day of shooting? Allegedly, I'm so confused about these little details. And that's why I feel like they need a Bravo courtroom show where we present as an audience, or even Andy, like, take a step by step through this. Treat me like I'm a child. Like, walk me through, Heather, this black eye. I feel like it's getting to that place because on YouTube, you're able to do these live streams that last for hours where you walk through every piece of a case and viewers or listeners are left like, you know, it satiates this appetite of being able to know the answers of why something is the way it is. And I believe there's a big mystery sometimes with these shows for us.
There is, and there's a lot of details left out, which leads to rampant speculation on the internet. And you know, hey, happy to have that as a conversation. But the thing that stuck out to me in the finale, the last episode of the finale, was that Monica owned the security cameras for Jen. If we're talking about the behind the scenes, like, I have so many questions. I have 30 minutes of a cross-examination I would like to engage in about the ownership of the security cameras. And I'm wondering, I need to know when those were put in. Is this that Jen knew that the feds were sniffing around? Because when Jen started filming, her co-defendants had been arrested. So Jen knew when filming began that the feds were closing, at least closing around her, and was getting very paranoid about which co-defendants were going to talk or not talk, because that's the way federal prosecutions work. And Coach had been an attorney. Jen is smart enough to know this, but I wonder if those cameras were put in Monica's name so that it would be harder to subpoena them and harder to get the records from the cameras because they weren't in Jen's name, making it a little bit harder to trace them and find them. It was fascinating to me, but was Monica really spying on Jen at home through this camera system? Like, that's behavior I've got a lot of questions about. Oh. And Andy just walked away from it. I was like, get back.
Or Monica, if you're listening, we'll set up a GoFundMe. What's the price where I can get Emily B. Baker to examine? Like, this is the hour show I need. Is Emily B. Baker with Monica Garcia, and we'll tell us what the price tag is on that. Because I mean, that's the other thing too. And I keep bringing up Heather, but I think Heather is smarter than Monica. I think Monica, in all intents and purposes, was kind of sloppy. I mean, she didn't have some grand plan. She was kind of troll. I mean, she was that kind of troll that she was like, it's really funny to drive by Jen Shaw's house and send it to your friends. Like, you're being goofy. But then when you present it and you're able to cherry pick and not add context to it, yeah, it looks really creepy. The camera stuff, you're right, though. That is another thing that is a huge issue. Okay, do you have like 10 more minutes?
I've got plenty of time. I love having a conversation with you. And
we've
talked all Salt Lake City, and it's, we're now watching like the art of housewifing, right? We're watching the behind the scenes almost setups of storylines and how things are playing out. And it's become a different viewing experience than it was a decade ago. It's wild. And now
it depends
on
second screen technology too. It depends on second screen technology and people like you, or even sometimes me, to actually present even further information. So you get a more 360 view of these shows that you dearly love. And I mean, you know, but I don't know. I sometimes feel like the violin for Heather of like playing the sad song of Andy, you said, you know, the online was going to be the worst. And I'm like, yes, there is truth to that. But also Heather uses that to her advantage as well, and is able to paint a case of being sympathetic towards her when her behavior was pretty abhorrent as well, to actually bring in production and say they possibly could have done this. I mean, that can't actually... I mean, I would go to say that Heather is just as charming as Jen Shaw, just in a different way, because she knows when to control it. She knows when to turn it down, and she knows when to turn it up.
I wonder how many internal investigations went on with the network because of what Heather said.
We know there was one. We know there was one. And that was wild. So you actually had an intern like that. That costs money. That can't be good. But At the end of the day, she did the receipt, screenshot, timeline proof. It got viral. So, and it, you know, you're
it
making
went
money.
Viral, and everybody's like, oh, it's iconic. And so, and it kind of, it is an iconic TV
it
moment.
Is.
And I think everybody's looking for those moments now when they record. I don't think they're as organic as they were. I think the Teresa Giudice table flipping was literally Teresa seeing red in like a fog of rage.
Yes.
But now I think people are looking for those moments. To bring
that's why Teresa was so brilliant, because it was so real. It came literally from her and not from a producer going, hey, do you think, or do you think, or them actually editing and producing themselves going, I'm going to show this audience a real good time, you know?
Yes.
Okay. So a couple of court questions I had, and this is one Sandra reminded me to ask you this because I read this week and I just am so confused. Is Scott Peterson is back in the news because the LA Innocence Project picked up his case. Scott Peterson is in prison for murdering his wife. And I always assumed if an Innocence Project takes a case up that, man, there must be really good evidence that this man is innocent. Where, you know, can you fill us in on any information about the Scott Peterson Innocence Project case?
Is it terrible that I wish I had more information? With Scott Peterson's case, there have been questions since the prosecution about the evidence, about what happened with the evidence. His family has maintained his innocence and that there were things in the prosecution that were not ideal. His defense attorneys have maintained that as well. I don't know what the Innocence Project found that triggered them to look into this more, but there's been appeals on this case since he was convicted. This was not an easy prosecution by any means. It is a entirely circumstantial case, and that always opens the door for concerns when you have an entirely circumstantial case. Did police jump to the wrong conclusion? Did they rush to judgment thinking, well, it had to be him? Did they ignore that there was someone else in the neighborhood that had had an issue and that there had been other crimes going on? So it will be interesting to see what they come up with when they take it up and probably file an amicus to the appellate court. But I have not had a chance to deep dive it just yet. But this has been rumbling in the background for at least the last year. There's been a lot more activity in that case. So I think we will see more conversation around where they're seeing holes in this prosecution and potentially things that you have to have something that was done wrong, not just, oh, well, the jury got it wrong. There has to be something that's procedurally flawed at this point. Prosecution hid evidence. Things weren't presented to the jury that could have been. Things weren't turned over to the defense. Those sorts of things that could overturn a conviction at this late point.
And I know you've been talking about Ruby Frank on your stream and your podcast and all of this stuff. And this is really fascinating because it's a mommy blogger, had a huge audience. And she pretty much, she pled guilty. She pled guilty to, child endangerment and a lot of other charges. But then there's another person involved that is going to, I don't know if she's going to trial or not, but I mean, Ruby pleading guilty, I mean, she's going to serve time, a great amount of time, correct?
Both Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrandt pled guilty to 4 counts of child abuse, essentially. It's a longer title in Utah, but it is 4 counts of both physical and psychological child abuse. The case is very, very sad. The underlying facts are absolutely awful. The sentencing will come up at the end of February. They will both be going to prison for some amount of time. There's going to be arguments over restitution. There's still a lot of questions about where the father, Kevin Frankie, was during this time, because Ruby and the kids had like moved to a different part of Utah and were living with Jody Hildebrandt and had told Kevin Frankie to not have contact with the kids, and he didn't. It's a very odd case for a family that had been so public on YouTube. But the public had been raising questions about the parenting methods of this family for a number of years. There had been petitions. People had called in Child Protective Services. Other adult children of the family had called Child Protective Services. So it,
you're glad they both pled guilty. But Jody Hildebrand also is presented almost in a Jen Shah style fashion, where Ruby Frankie was saying that, you know, once she came into contact with Miss Hildebrand, you know, she led her to believe certain things and to change her way, her lifestyle. And I found that interesting as well. And to see more details come out about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I was just saying about Jody Hildebrand kind of being a Jen Shah style character.
Both Ruby Frankie and her husband, Kevin Frankie, had said that Jody Hildebrand's the one who made them do all of this. It's a difficult argument for me to understand that someone made you abuse your own children in the way this abuse played out. But they are both trying to blame Jody as being really the kingpin and telling them that this was the way they had to parent their children. What's so shocking and sad about that is that Jody Hildebrand ran a like parenting course and counseling where she was telling other people that these methods were what was effective and appropriate and really preying on people who were looking for help.
The only thing I just wanted an update on is Brian Koberger, because the Idaho murders, I'm so confused on where we're at. There was a lot of buzz and press about this when it initially happened last Thanksgiving. Where are we at now? Are we close or closer to trial? I'm confused.
Of course you're confused. The court has sealed almost everything that's been going on. So quite a lot of it is not in the public view. There's a hearing coming up on Friday, January 26th, 27th. In Idaho, half the hearing is sealed, half the hearing is public. Maybe we'll get a trial date set at that hearing. They've still been arguing over DNA and discovery, but Koberger's team is indicating that they want to take another appeal. If they are granted the right to appeal, it's going to pause the entire proceeding until that appeal is done. So this case might stall very quickly if their ability to appeal in the middle of proceeding to trial is granted. And that could take some time. So we'll see.
I thought I had read something also where they had just gotten approval for cameras in the courtroom. So was that not the case?
The court kicked out media cameras in the courtroom, and the court decided that they were going to stream it themselves over their courtroom cameras to their YouTube channel directly. So media cameras have now all been kicked out. No video recording, no still photography, nothing. Courts in Idaho are doing this, and I think we're going to see more courts do this, where the court has been fitted for Zoom court because of the pandemic, and they're just going to use those court cameras and feed them out on the internet. And that's it. They're taking full control. So cameras are now available in streaming. They're not media cameras or court TV cameras. They're the court's own cameras.
Who does that help in the long run?
I think it's good for transparency in the courts, because there's no gatekeeping over who can have access to the court feed or not the court feed. And the court's in control of it. The court had been fighting with the still photographers and the camera operators a lot in Idaho, where the judge would be talking and the camera would be zoomed in on Brian Koberger's face. And the court kept saying, stop doing that. You need to show all of the proceedings. You can't just zoom in on the defendant's face for the whole proceeding and then, you know, pick out his behavior because he raised an eyebrow. We saw this in the Gwyneth Paltrow case operate very well. There were court orders that the pan had to be of the entire courtroom and you could only focus on who was speaking, and the media adhered to those rules. I think we're going to see more C-SPAN type court coverage, less dramatic pans on a defendant's face, and more courts going to their own court feed. I think, though court TV and other large networks might be frustrated that they can't control the feeds, it makes the feeds accessible to anyone who wants to watch. And with a case that impacted two university communities, the public, especially in Moscow and in Idaho and in Washington, need to be able to watch those proceedings, because they're so there's no ability for them to go in person because the courtrooms are too small. And there's such a large community that was impacted by this because it happened really covering two college campuses. So I think it's better for the public to have easy access to watch what happens in court.
Yeah. I mean, that case, or, you know, even that, just, it just kept me up at night, and I'm just kind of wondering when this is actually going to start going. So Emily, what else is coming up for you now? Because you are busy nonstop. I imagine you have a lot of opportunities that you're probably sifting through. What's on the vision board for 2024? Do you go into a new year with kind of like, this is what I want to try, this is what I want to do, because you have this amazing audience right now? What is next for Emily D. Baker?
What's next is more live court coverage on YouTube. I've been partnering with other independent media outlets to get court feeds, so we're not as beholden to when feeds are getting put out by which networks. I've been covering the Murdaugh case. There's a couple other very large, high-profile criminal cases that'll be going to trial that I'm interested to see how they play out. So there's a lot of court coverage to come. The Rust case, Alec Baldwin, of course, just got indicted again, but again, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed is going to trial in February. We might see a Tom Girardi
is
trial.
Is Hannah the armorer?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So the armorer should be going to trial in February. We should be getting a Tom Girardi trial in May in federal court.
Because they found him fit to stand trial. They found him fit. Wow.
Yes, they did. They found him to be a liar is what they found him to be. For all of the internet that was like, he's faking. I'm like, we don't know. Let's see how it wills out. And then the court's like, he's malingering. I'm like, ha ha, faking. So we should get a Girardi federal trial in May. We've got oral arguments on the Chrisley appeal coming to federal court in April. There is the Sarah Boone case still looming, the Sarah Reed case still looming. Corey Richens, the woman who's accused of fentanyling her husband in a Moscow mule in Utah.
Yeah.
That doesn't have a trial date, but I'm waiting for the next date on that. It's been moving along. So
Utah,
there are quite,
maybe she's going to be on Salt Lake City next season.
I mean, from custody, she's not getting out of prison or jail anytime soon.
Yeah.
We've got Donna Adelson, which is this crazy case. Her son was just convicted and she's arrested in the airport trying to flee the country on a one-way ticket for a murder that happened of her son-in-law almost 10 years ago. It is a winding and wild case, but they've been prosecuting it like bit by bit by bit. So her going to trial is going to be very interesting to see, which may also happen this year. So lots of criminal cases, lots of female defendants right now. And then, of course, the Scientology Leah Remini case has a ton of litigation going on in LA.
Wow.
So more court cases.
You're doing what you do best. But also, I mean, when's the book coming out? Because I feel like I was thinking about that. I was like, no, I'm honest, Emily, like, I want to read a book of Emily D. Baker taking us through some of these iconic court cases or even your coverage of these court cases. That's an automatic book in my head. Like, in my head, that's done. Like, is that in your future potentially?
I keep getting asked about it. So at some point, I will have to sit down and put form to it. We recently launched the Law Nerd app.
You could do bad YouTuber instead of bad Mormon. You could do bad.
I am the worst YouTuber, Ryan. I love what I do. I feel like we've kind of broken the platform because I do it so differently than other YouTube creators. And I love being a YouTuber. But people will ask me like the ins and outs of my analytics and stuff. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't pay attention.
Yeah.
I go live. I talk to my people. We have a great time. But we recently launched an app, the Law Nerd app, to fix kind of the notification issues for when we're covering a trial so people don't miss witnesses that are coming up that they want to hear, so we can help the law nerds be productive during. I mean, the Murdaugh case was 6 weeks. Depp Heard case was 7 weeks. It's a long time to be invested in a case. And so we can notify people so they don't miss the parts they want to see. And that's been really fun. So that's been a huge project off our plate that we were really excited to launch right at the end of 2023. So what's coming this year? More court coverage. And maybe me in person in court. Britney Spears has a trial coming up on her accountings in May.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I might just move to LA in May. I don't know. We're gonna remember about
the traffic this time, Emily. Don't be late for these court cases. And
I mean,
it really is ridiculous.
Down by court. It's ridiculous. I can't even. When I come to visit, depending on where I have events, my parents are like, are you staying down by us? I'm like, if I have to be in downtown LA every day, no. The answer is no. I'll stay in downtown.
What an amazing life. And my favorite thing about Emily D. Baker, you probably already know this, but if you don't follow her, huge fan of Dave Matthews Band. That is one of my favorite things about Emily D. Baker. I love when I see you're like going to a concert or going to a run of concerts. That makes my heart feel good. I'm like, yeah. Like, I love those things where you're like, I can connect with somebody on that. I love that you love Dave Matthews Band.
I'm such a nerd. I really do love live music. Living in Nashville has been so great for that. The summer concert tour scheduled this season, this summer 2024, I have a lot of salt about. So I'm trying to unwind my saltiness, but like the venue I wanted to go to with friends is right during VidCon in LA, and I will be at VidCon. And so I'm like, why are you performing here right during VidCon? Like, what are we doing? Why are you performing there 4th of July? It's hard to be a fan.
It's hard to be a fan.
Concert schedules mess up my whole summer, but these court cases and concert schedules, I'm going to have to figure it out.
Oh, we just had one more freeze. I marked it. You're going to Vegas. Okay. Oh, can you hear me? Okay. So
yes,
you guys, I'm going to put all of Emily's, all of the links in there, but you already know her and love her. But if you don't, you got to give her YouTube channel, her podcast, all of that stuff. You are going to be an instant fan if you are not already. Emily D. Baker, thank you so much for taking this much time with us today. You are truly one of my favorites and so gracious and amazing at what you do. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Ryan. It's so great. I mean, when I went to law school, I never imagined that this would get to be my life. And I'm so thankful that it is, right? Because I get to have conversations about the stuff that I love with you, like pop culture. We got to do a full deep dive analysis of Salt Lake, and I'm living for it. So thank you for having me.
Anytime you have an itch, it's come. Yes. Thank you, Emily.
So Bad It's Good is a Betches Media production. The show is hosted and produced by me, Ryan Bailey, with Meditza Lopez and Sandra Fryer. Additional support provided by Sean Kilby, Jorge Morales-Pico, and Rebecca Steinberg. Guest booking by Ali Friedlander. Video promotion by Laura Valencia. Be sure to send us your emails at sobaditsgoodwithryanbailey@gmail.com and follow the show at sobaditsgoodwithryanbailey on Instagram. And for additional craziness, go to patreon.com/sobaditsgood. Stay bad, baddies.
Betches.